this is Angela Ewing with KCIW, Curry Coast Community Radio. Story time, 9 o'clock horses, episode 19. Joseph's suggestion to return to New York filled me with dread. He knew he could get a job as a pharmacist quite easily. I would sooner have stayed in Rochester. But he pointed out that we'd have no car and he wasn't about to travel to work on a bus. Obviously, I decided he had no idea how a lot of people managed in New York. With a bus, subway part of their daily life, he was spoiled. As his father had said, always having a car. Now he was determined to borrow money from his friend, so we could go to California and visit his cousin, certain that she and her husband would let us have a room in their house until he'd found a job. We took a train to New York City, and his friend Bernie and his wife Sophie made up a bed for us in their miniature spare room. It was a very strange situation. I felt we were really intruding, but in a few days, Joseph had located an agency who needed someone to drive a car to California. The owner was elderly and was flying to Van Nuys. We had 1 week to get the car to California. I remember the car, a black Buick with soft suspension. It bounced on every bump. With no air conditioning, we travelled with all the windows open and I dangled my legs outside to try and keep cool. It seemed an endless journey of 500 miles a day across the United States on Route 66. When we arrived in Oklahoma, the car had steam coming from the engine. Joseph suggested it had overheated and it would need drastic repair. I had visions of his being stranded, but, as always, he did not panic. He called the agency back in New York, who said luckily there was an agency in Oklahoma. A miracle, I thought. This time we were given a station wagon with air conditioning, a treat when driving through the desert. The tiny town of Needles was the ugliest place I had ever seen in my life. L.A. was the busiest, and I hated them both. Joseph's cousin Eva and her husband Sal lived in Monterey Park. It was obvious they adored Joseph, but they were wary of me. I was a Shiksa, a species not really acceptable in their world, and yet they did eventually accept me. I presume because I was Joseph's sweetheart. I did learn how to make knishes and challah, the delicious soft egg bread for Rosh Hashanah, one of the Jewish holidays. I liked almost all of the dishes that Eva made, but I certainly missed bacon for breakfast. Really, it made sense, their ruling about pork, associated with trichinosis, a long time ago. Also, shellfish. It is a bottom fish, like clams, and that's considered treif, not allowed. Luckily, we were able to stay with his cousin for a month while Joseph checked out every pharmacy from Alhambra to the coastal towns of Torrance, Redondo Beach, Manhattan Beach, and all the areas in between. He was not one to sit around and mope. He was enthusiastic about finding a place for us to live. He told me that would be somewhere I liked. Within a month, Joseph had found a position as a pharmacist at Thrifty Drugstore in San Pedro. He knew I loved the ocean, and we searched for an apartment in Redondo Beach, where he had once visited. He said, I would like it, and I did. Somehow, in the confusion of change in all things in my life, I had put aside the fact that I was not yet married to this adoring man. It was only when we were exploring Mexico, just before he was due to start work, I suddenly remembered there was something missing. It jarred my senses to realize what it was. I hadn't missed that monthly inconvenience, but now it was of prime importance. What to do? Thinking seriously about it, I decided it wasn't entirely absurd because Joseph was an ardent lover. Of course, I really didn't believe I could be pregnant. Yet, after another worried week passed by, I had to accept the fact that maybe it was true. What would people say? Pregnant and not married, shame on me. I could hear my mother's voice now. Well, only bad girls get into trouble like that, isn't it shocking? When I finally managed to tell Joseph my fears, he smiled. Wonderful, he said. We shall get married here in Mexico. Why wait? Well, it wasn't quite the wedding I'd once planned with Colin. We found a small registry office in the state of Tlaxcala in Mexico, where we were enjoying the wonderfully historic buildings. It was a fast ceremony, but I had to believe that it was the only thing to do under the circumstances. I began to wonder if our marriage was legal in the States, but I had a piece of paper, a marriage certificate. I was convinced it didn't really matter anyway, because no one would have to know. From then on, I told everyone we were married in Rochester, a lie that after a while seemed to be true to me. When you tell a lie often enough, you begin to believe it. Joseph seemed overjoyed at the prospect of becoming a father. Wasn't I the lucky one? He almost obsessed about it. Then I discovered I was not pregnant. Joseph actually broke down and cried. It's all right, I said. We have time. You said you were pregnant. His voice had an edge to it. Just for a moment, I saw suspicion in his mind. Did he really think I would pretend to be pregnant so he'd marry me? Well, I let that thought go. There was nothing I could do about it now. I was looking forward to being a dad, he said. Well, I suspect it was all because of the stress, I said, that gave the false alarm. You know, it does happen sometimes. Within 3 months, Joseph had had enough money to put a deposit on a very nice apartment on the Esplanade in Redondo Beach. We had an ocean view. I walked on the beach every day and was looking in the local paper for a job close by. Joseph managed to find a used car, and I was happy to be without one, actually. Having never driven in the US, I was relieved. My life in Redondo Beach was idyllic, especially when I found out I was pregnant. This time, I consulted a doctor in Torrance, and he confirmed it. Joseph was elated. I swam in the pool that was set in the center of lush landscaping with palms and birds of paradise. I swam in the ocean when I had the courage. And Joseph brought home some salve that he had concocted at the drugstore with it to rub on my belly every night. He said I would never have stretch marks, and I never did. At Thrifty Drugstore, he made friends quickly. His workmates came often to the apartment in Redondo to sample his five-layer gâteau. Joseph didn't drink alcohol, but he was a master cake maker, and he measured every spoonful of flour and sugar with the glass measuring vials he used at work. Of course, the cakes didn't do much for his weight. I could see now why he tended to have a little extra flesh around his middle, his love of sweets. He was expert at making a gin fizz for me on occasion, which he would serve outside on the patio with a warning, "Only one." He was so attentive, I felt like a queen. I wrote to my parents, told them they shouldn't worry about me one bit, that I was very happy and secure in a relationship that was wonderful. To me, it was almost too good to be true. At Christmas, Joseph arrived with a huge Douglas fir. We had to cut some off the bottom before it would fit. He never had had a Christmas or a tree. He bought so many glass balls and insisted on decorating the tree by himself. "We do the Festival of Lights," he said. "It's pretty, but not like your Christmas. And we have a menorah for the candles." He explained everything about Hanukkah that I found delightful. That Christmas, we had a menorah and a tree. His next purchase was a 1961 Ford Thunderbird for me. I took the driving test and passed, another miracle. The Thunderbird was really not the car I should have been driving. At 5'3", I could barely reach the pedals, and if I went over a bump, The front of the car lifted off the ground and seemed to float for a few seconds, obliterating my vision of the road. The soft suspension of this American vehicle was not at all like the hard-riding car in which I'd learned to drive as a teenager, and even with a couple of cushions, I was still too low in the seat for that car. It seemed that Joseph wanted to fill our lives with everything he deemed necessary for a family to be complete. And one evening, he came home with a puppy, a miniature Doberman Pinscher. She was black and tan, a purebred, and she came with instructions to have the ears properly cropped and wrapped so they would stick up like a true Doberman. I thought that was a bit barbaric, but it was done. When she stuck her head under my blouse one day while I was holding her, I said, "Oh, you are cheeky." That, of course, became her name. For some reason, Joseph decided two dogs were better than one. "Company for each other," he said. He arrived with another minipin who became Tammy. One gorgeous day, Joseph and I were walking on the beach. I took off running, splashing through the surf, and when I looked back, he was running too. Suddenly, I was aware that he wasn't directly behind me. I saw he had stopped and was leaning over. I ran back to see what was the matter, saw his ashen face, his lips turning blue. "We have to get back to the apartment," he whispered. "I don't feel well." I had to help him up two flights of steps to the second floor. Joseph was 6 feet tall and broad in the chest. I could hardly believe this was the same man who always seemed to be the one to help people in any way he could. The one to volunteer to help push a stranded car out of the way of traffic. Being very pregnant, I couldn't really hold his weight as he struggled up the steps. He knew he couldn't rely on me to hold him. He struggled onto the handrail, hauling himself up, step by step. I was panic-stricken when he collapsed onto the floor of the apartment. I didn't know what to do. He had no doctor. I had a wonderful obstetrician, but we never thought about Joseph. I ran to the manager's office and explained to her that my husband had almost passed out. She called her own doctor, who agreed to come by later. "Although," she said, "perhaps we should call an ambulance." Joseph was admitted to a hospital in Torrance. The doctor who attended him was brisk. He turned to me, the stethoscope still swinging from his neck. "Your husband has a bad heart, you know that." Until then, I had no idea. And I, in my naivety, never wondered about the moments he had chosen to stop, often on our frequent walks, along the pier in Redondo or the park. I must have appeared like an idiot as I answered the doctor. No, I didn't know. St. Mary's in Long Beach was one of the leading cardiac hospitals in the country. And during the next examination, the doctor was again brief in his assessment of Joseph's prognosis. Using a Jewish term of endearment, he said, "Boychek, I'm happy to tell you there's a brand new procedure now, a mitral valve. It's a replacement valve that can be inserted into the heart. Star Edwards Ball, it's called." He leaned forward in his chair to look directly at Joseph. "I would advise that you seriously consider this procedure. It's a major cardiac surgery, but without it, your days will be numbered." I took a deep breath. Joseph was 26. He had a congenital heart problem, and he hadn't discussed it with me ever. I thought that was odd, and I asked him later. He said, "You wouldn't have married me if you'd have known that, would you?" Actually, I had no answer to that. I really wasn't sure. I wondered at that moment if his parents, obviously aware of the situation, had been testing me to see if I really would marry someone who was likely to die young. Were they trying to warn me, do me a favor, or what, when they asked me to stay clear of their son? Would they have assumed Joseph had told me his condition? It was food for thought. To make things even more serious, when I asked the doctor how successful the surgeries had been in the past, he said, "Well, that's a tough question. This mitral valve is new, and it depends a lot on the person. I would say with Joseph's condition, it's, 50-50. 50-50? Those words did little to instill me with the confidence to take that step. I said, "Well, no, then we'll wait and get a second opinion." "Just don't take too long," the surgeon said. Now Joseph seemed only to be cognizant of my safety and my well-being. He didn't want to drive the car with me in it, in case he passed out. He worried all the time about that. Then another problem arose. The apartment manager told us that babies were not allowed. We had to move. As it happened, the two-story house next door, old though it was vacant. The bottom floor was used for storage, but the top floor was lovely, with large rooms and a very big deck that overlooked the ocean. All along the esplanade, houses were being replaced with apartment buildings, so we knew it was temporary. But it was wonderful for me to see the ever-changing ocean from the window. Joseph, however, still reluctant to make a decision about the open-heart surgery, would stand on the deck for hours staring out to sea. "I'm going to have that surgery, you know," he said. "Not yet," I pleaded. "Please wait until the baby comes." I could not imagine me trying to look after him and a newborn at the same time. I was no nurse. Even the sight of blood made me feel faint. One early September evening, there was an earthquake. My two minipins shot out the door, down the steps, and out onto the street. They had never run away before, and even though the door was always open, I always felt that they'd stay inside. I ran down the steps, down the street. I finally found them at one of the apartment entrances, way down the block. As I was carrying the dogs back home, my water broke. I went into labor that night, and my daughter was born early the next morning. She was a week early. Joseph was with me all the birthing, telling the nurses what to do. "Give her more Demerol," I heard him say. I'm sure they were irritated with him for being there, but I was happy. When the doctor finally brought my daughter to me, he said, "Congratulations. She has 10 little fingers and 10 little toes. She's almost perfect." "Almost?" I said, "Almost?" I just wanted to hold my baby and not be told she was not totally perfect. She was so pretty to me, with a lot of hair, at least for a newborn. I never bought into the theory that all newborns are beautiful, but she was one, and the nurses had brushed her hair up into a curl. The doctor hovered over me and my baby for a minute or two before he said, "She has to have surgery immediately, Amelia." "Surgery? What for? What's wrong?" I felt panic rise and my heart quicken. This could not be happening to me or my baby. I was too frightened to be intimidated. "Explain it to me," I said. I was suddenly angry. I don't know why I shouted, but I did. "Tell me what's wrong." He sighed, sat down on the bed, reached for my hand. "She has a fistula. That means no anus. We're going to have to make one." He went on quickly. "One baby in every 5,000 births. It's called an imperforate anus, meaning the bladder, rectum, and vagina share one large hole. It's known as a fistula. We have to make a new opening." I knew I was staring at him intently. "How is that done?" "It's a procedure called perineal anoplasty. We close the fistula and create a new anus. She will need constant attention from the surgery. Special bullet-shaped instruments will be supplied to you. And it's your responsibility to dilate and stretch the new opening every day until she's about a year old." My head began to ache. I was totally bewildered, angry and numb. It was all too much for me, and I really didn't understand half of it. When Joseph came to see me, he looked as though he wanted to cry, but he didn't. Instead, he said, "It's all right. We'll cope. She'll be fine, and I'll take care of everything. It's not that unusual." 1 in 5,000 births, not unusual? "Honey, it's happened," he said. "She'll be fine, I promise." But it really wasn't fine. She looked perfect. But when Joseph finally broke down and wept, it was to tell me that the doctor had said, "She may never be able to have children." It was only then I thought my heart would break. You've been listening to episode 19 of 9 O'Clock Horses. Listen next week to episode 20. This is Angela Ewing with KCIW Curry Coast Community Radio. Thank you for listening.